Session number 13265, reel number 29.
Mr. Marsden, reel 29.
Oh, yes, we were making our own distilled water to use in our oxygen compressors. The word got around, and we were swamped with people who came along wanting us to make runs of their jungle juice. They wanted to dollop their stuff into our distilled water, into our boiler, and have that distilled off to produce highly potent stuff. And as I pointed out, there was no way I was going to contaminate my still with their rubbish. And secondly, if I were to pass it through, it wasn't a copper tank, it wasn't a stainless steel tank. We'd had to make it of the materials we had available, which were galvanised iron. Then I wouldn't have guaranteed what it might do to their socks if we ran that stuff through that still and then they drank it. Because, when they saw what we'd got, some of them, of course, were going to go off and scrounge up stuff from wrecked aircraft and make their own stills. I've even heard of people distilling glycol to get the alcohol out and whatnot. And when you think of the product that might come out, you can be quite horrified. Anyway, there was quite a lot of it was going on all over the islands because apparently pretty well every ship that went back from New Zealand went back like Mormac Wren with its load of this kind of cargo. The orderlies were not the nicest people you might wish to meet on a dull day. Possibly they were pretty well hardened by the job. They were contemptuous of the people in their charge. Not all of them were there because they were simply weak types who'd resorted to jungle juice and had taken the results. The results, if I didn't mention it adequately before, of this kind of thing are apt to be blindness, dementia, partial or more or less greater or less paralysis. The catalogue of physical damage that these chaps had done to themselves was quite ginormous. And unfortunately, these orderlies tended to regard everybody who went back with them under this heading as being of the same order. Well, some of them, in fact, of course, were combat veterans who were shell-shocked, but they were being treated in the same fairly harsh fashion, frankly, not very differently from the way they, as I said before, they treated their prisoners when they put them in the brig, offenders. And the orderlies, to whom we chattered a little bit on an occasional meantime, you could see were delighted to offer us the chance of going down and having a look over their kingdom. Well, I decided that this was something I should see, so I went down and regretted it. It's probably one of the most disgusting sights I've ever seen, to see these poor, miserable so-and-sos in these padded boxes living in their own shit. And, dear. Some of them, obviously, only distant related to being human beings at all by now. A terrible sight. So, anyway, we get into San Francisco, and we have the job of getting from the ship up to Angel Island. No truck. We have to cart our own gear. And I have, I think, 3 or 4 kit bags by this time. Which meant, and it was uphill, I nearly gave myself a hernia struggling away with this load of stuff. One of my kit bags was, in fact, a box inside a kit bag. I'd made a plywood box which fitted exactly into the kit bag, a rectangular box, and this I'd filled with tinned foods to take home, including 10-pound tins of New Zealand honey, 10-pound tins of New Zealand cheese, and various other tins of meats and salmon and whatever that I could gather together, because I knew that by this time rationing was fairly stiff at home. So what with one thing or another, I was fairly cluttered, and to add to that, I decided that I'd buy myself a Valpak while I was in the States, and went into a shop in Frisco and bought a large Valpak, into which I put all my travelling gear, so that the kit bags could be closed off, and if I'm separated from them, it wouldn't matter. But I had I could carry a spare suit of blue in the Valpak, and my shirts and spare shoes and whatnot, and all my kit, so that from then on, when travelling, I didn't need to find a wardrobe or a cupboard or whatever they gave us in any of the transit billets or whatever. I could simply hang up the Valpak, open it, and there I am. I've got a travelling wardrobe. Worked a treat. And 3 or 4 days in Frisco, and the word comes round, everybody hurry up down to the quayside. You're across the harbour into Auckland and on the train. And once again, up and down that perishing hill with all this kit, no truck provided, into a Higgins boat, and belt away across San Francisco Harbour, swinging in past Alcatraz again. We'd come in past Alcatraz on the way, and we get the whole story of Alcatraz from our friendly tourist guide, the coxswain who's driving the Higgins, and across the harbour to Auckland, and so on to the train, and set off transcontinental for New York. And I can't remember which railway we started out on. I used to know it. I've forgotten some double barrel name. Anyway, San Francisco, and up through the Rockies, the James Tunnel, which is now closed and out of use, the Dots Road Cut-Off, which is on the same line, out of use, over ginormously tall wooden trestles in various places, a marvellous rail drive through the Rockies, down to Denver, and then Salt Lake City, and on to Chicago, where we change trains, and where we get half a day to ourselves, and a whole afternoon to ourselves. So we New Zealand party, as it were, the UK party and New Zealanders, we clamber aboard a taxi, and we get a ride round the city to find out what Chicago's like, have a look at the lake and so on. And then I found myself a model shop and bought myself a box of X-Acto modelling knives, which I still have, ready for when Bolter is available again after the war and I can take up my hobby of model aeroplanes. And away we get on the train and set off again through all the place names we've all heard of on the way to New York, Peoria, and of course, having said that, of course, every perishing name drops out of my head. Pennsylvania. We went through Pennsylvania, not Philadelphia. What's Pittsburgh? So Pittsburgh and the other big car manufacturing town.
Detroit,
some all that kind of stuff all the way down there, and go rolling into New York. It's April by now, and in New York we're provided with digs on 42nd Street, just down the road from Jack Dempsey, on the opposite side from Jack Dempsey's restaurant, and the I think it's what you call a sorority house or something of that order. The I guess in peacetime it would belong to one of the universities, the Phi Kappa Delta, which was a kind of 4 or 5 story, rather like an apartment house, where I suppose the university students and people could take rooms. And there we're taken in hand by one of these ladies' associations who made it their duty to look after troops in transit. They tell us that anything we wish to buy to take home, if we make a list of it, they'll get it for us at the best prices, and so on, which we do. And we're informed too that there will be free tickets to shows and nightclubs down at the desk, and I hear about that just in time to gallop down and miss getting tickets for Oklahoma, which is just on at the time. So we take second best and we go to Billy Rose's Diamond Horseshoe nightclub, where we have free tickets for admission instead of paying $15 cover charge, and where we get a meal and the floor show. A meal and a drink and the floor show. The meal is about 27 Heinz beans on a slice of toast. And the drink is half a glass of beer. But the floor show was something else again. Gypsy Rose Lee and all the girls, all 6-footers. And we are descended upon by a gang of young ladies who are hostesses, college students and the like, who make it their voluntary duty to meet the troops and so on. I was married, remember, before we went out, so as far as I was concerned, that was it. These were hostesses, and when none of us made any moves in the direction that you see on the films, we must all have been slow, I suppose. But anyway, it was quite a good do, and that wasn't the first night. That was second or third night at the Phi Kappa Delta. The first thing they do when we get there is to get a thoroughly good bath, because by the time we've crossed America, it's taken us 5 or 7 days, I've forgotten just how many, but about that length of time, I find that all I have to do in the morning when I get up out of my sleeper is to put my uniform on and immediately get black rings where the uniform touches me. My clothes are impregnated with soot, and in fact, by the time we get to New York, I decide that suit of blue has to go to the cleaners before I can wear it again. And when I stripped off properly, I was a darkish grey with black patches, and I suppose we must have all been the same, because we certainly all of us got into the bath and had a thorough good soak that night, and went to bed for a nice long sleep, which wasn't interrupted by, you know, that wild lonely whistle of the American train in the middle of the prairie at night, you know, echoing and ringing across empty vastness, or the conductor shouting, "All aboard!" You know, in the exactly the way you hear it on the films, that's spot on. That is the loneliest cries you hear in this world, I think. Get a head down in a bed that's just lying still on the deck. And we slept. I slept. And I wakened up to a world that seemed awfully silent and hushed. When we'd gone to bed the night before, you know, out in the street, there was a fair old racket from New York traffic. And we wake up in the morning and all is deathly silence. And there might well be 2 foot of snow outside and snowing like crazy. And God. Although, I mean, I've been now back from the islands a couple of months. I look out there and I'm, oh dear, did I shiver. And I was in no hurry to go out either. The only other thing of major importance as far as I was concerned with regard to my stay in New York, apart from remembering the nightclub trip, was the fact that I found Polk's model shop, a model aeroplane shop. Polk's, at that time, was probably the most famous model aeroplane shop in the world due to the fact that they advertised in all the American model aeroplane magazines, which got all over the world. So I knew about it. So I found it, and I went in there and was deeply disappointed to find that all this wealth of American modelling material, which I took for granted, had gone kafut because of the war. And that balsa, for instance, was totally off the market. There were hardly any balsa kits at all. Most of the kits now were being made, were using stripped pine, white pine material, or spruce, and where sheet balsa had been used, they were using a kind of soft cardboard. Nevertheless, I bought a couple. And engines? Well, there were no new engines being made, or if they were, they were being sold straight out of the factory. They weren't getting into the shops. And so they had these second-hand engines, and I bought a couple. And bitter regret to this day ever parting with them, because each of those engines today would be worth about £150 each. I bought them, as I recall, I think I paid about $6 or $8 each for them. In old money, when it was $5 to the pound. And anyway, as I say, that was really was the highlight of my New York visit. So I'm equipped to go home. And we go back to the Phi Kappa Delta one day, and we're told, get your gear together, you're being moved out to New Rochelle, an army camp at New Rochelle, which was a kind of transit camp for troops going to Europe. And there we find that although we're all sergeants, this is the same thing I've mentioned before about the relative seniority of RAF sergeants and sergeants in the US forces, we're treated, just like any private or anything else. We are not regarded as being senior NCOs. And so if we go out from camp at New Rochelle, for instance, into New York, and come in again in the evening, as we go in and give our name and are checked off, there's a character sitting behind a desk saying, flash it and milk it. Open your trousers, get your penis out, milk it down to see whether there's any signs of gonorrhea or anything. Flash it and milk it, regardless, you know.
So they could study the sperm?
Well, to see whether you'd had sex, and see if you'd had sex, then you were to have early treatment, of course. In the British services, it was done much more discreetly. Anybody who went out of camp, when he went back in, went through, booked in through the main gate, and there was alongside a little room called the ET room. You've come across this?
Mm-hmm.
And you went in there, and you picked up I've never had to do it, but you picked up a tube of antiseptic ointment of some sort, inserted it into the end of the sperm of the penis, squeezed the stuff down into the urethra, and there you were supposedly at least sorted out against venereal disease of some sort or other. I don't know. I don't know how it went on for syphilis with that, but the Americans handled it, to my way of thinking, quite crudely, and we all resented this treatment quite bitterly, I think. Certainly I did. After all, I was married before I went, I was still virgin, for God's sake. I bitterly resented the whole thing. But, and just to add a nice little footnote to the whole proceedings, the popular song of the day would be playing in the background. Paper Doll. Yeah, I can still see. When I hear Paper Doll, I still see that dimly lit sort of bit of a corridor with a table alongside and these Yanks Snowdrops sitting there ordering us about as though we were trash. Oh, I could have kicked them in the teeth, I really could. Anyway, three or four days at Newryssel. This, I haven't a clue as to our sleeping accommodation. For all my memory, it shows how things like this are shut off. I can't remember what the dining hall was like at New Rochelle. I can recall what it was like in Angel Island, and I still have, when we were at Angel Island, I still have quite a good picture of the huts, which were cheap and nasty, wood-lapped huts, rather like the ones I mentioned in New Zealand. The dining halls were of the same order, cheap, thin construction. You could practically spit through the walls. The wind got through, certainly. And I remember going in there for my first meal, comparing it with the meals even in the islands, and taking, you know, one of those stainless steel multi-pocketed trays and going down the counter, and the character behind the counter slapping down, one of them slapping onto the tray a slice of toast, and another one getting a scoop and slapping down on it some brown stuff. And I said, "What's this?" And he said, "Shit on a shingle." And that picture stays with me too. and the term. Oh, dear. Anyway, one morning, New Rochelle, never any previous warning, of course, because of security. Right, so-and-so, party, get your gear together, down to so-and-so, and we take all our kit bags and so on, and drag ourselves off and aboard a truck, and we go down to Pier 82 or 84, which is the one where the Mary sailed from in New York. If you speak to any American troops, they'll give you the right number, but it was, as I say, 82 or 84. We went on to a kind of powered lighter sort of vessel from New Rochelle. Don't ask me how we sailed down to that pier or where New Rochelle is in relation to it and whatnot. I only know that eventually we seemed to be sailing down some sort of river, and we sailed through a sewer upwelling, a huge sewage upwell. And in the middle of this upwelling, effectively in the middle of it, was an island which I should think had all of about 3 or 4 inches freeboard. And stuck in the middle of this island was a small house and a lighthouse. And the view from the island in any direction was New York sewage, full of the usual brown stuff, sanitary towels and condoms. Hundreds of yards in any direction. A most elegant view. Ugh. And not too sweet either. And so on. Anyway, down the river or wherever, whatever piece of water this was, and into the harbour and onto the Pier 84, where we find ourselves going aboard the Queen Mary, all in grey. We were on D deck, well aft, over the starboard outer prop, as we found out to our horror later on. I don't know how long we waited for the rest of the loading to take place. We discovered there were 11,000 American troops aboard, in addition to our small party of Brits and New Zealanders. And once again we discovered that messing would be 2 meals a day. But in the 3 weeks crossing the Pacific, if you remember, I'd said I'd got myself, Mrs. Percival had fed me up and got me overweight before I left New Zealand. Well, in that 3 weeks, I'd lost something like 2 stone. I was down to well under 11 stone again, quite smartly. The rations were small, and twice a day is a very good way of slimming. Yeah, it really is. I remember still the... Now hear this! Now hear this! Chow down! Last call! Chow down! And if you hadn't heard it before, and if you weren't slippy, by God, it was last call and you'd missed it. But aboard the Mary, 2 meals a day, and I think there were 5 sittings a day for each meal, which, of course, does account for only having 2 meals a day, because with 5 sittings for each meal, it doesn't leave a lot of time in the day in between times. Well... I don't know whether the rest of the American troops were in cabins or anything. We didn't explore the ship. In fact, technically, we were not allowed to explore it. Everyone was under strict orders. You can go from where you sleep to this place on the deck, and you can't go anywhere else. You aren't allowed to go anywhere else in the ship. Because with 11,000 people aboard, I suppose they discovered that it was possible with 11,000 Americans, for Americans to get themselves lost and create a right old kerfuffle in trying to find their way back to their buddies and one thing or another. And they'd simply come out with the simple rule, you learn your way from here where you sleep to the dining hall and back. You learn your way from here where you sleep to the deck and your abandoned ship station and back. And that is all you do, you see. So that was the way it was. And since she was technically under the control of the Americans, whilst the Americans were aboard, we weren't about to cross any American MPs and get ourselves into dead stuck with those perishers, because they are not easy people to get on with. However, we did break the rules on one occasion. We were standing dutifully in our appointed square foot of space, almost literally, since with 11,000 people on board, all getting out onto the decks during the day, there aren't many square feet of space available per head or per foot or per both feet. You know, and it really isn't easy to move. It's like being in an English town in the old days on Saturday afternoon market day. You know, you literally are shoulder to shoulder all the way down High Street. Don't see so much of it now, but the way it was. Or a football crowd. Anyway, we're in our place when one of the crowd of Yanks we're on the starboard side, because our cabin's on the starboard side, and there's a crowd of Yanks over the port side, and some of them can see, of course, that we're differently clad from them, and since we're differently clad from them, we are different. That means we have to be picked on. And they started giving us all the usual American bull. Now, these buds, remember, haven't been out of the States.